This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Thanks very much. Well, good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. The last one actually was last night in Belfast. You know, I feel like a show band. You know, I don't just go from to the next town. I have to go to the far end of the country. This afternoon we're going to be looking at the Irish Revolution, local or global? Now, the runaway success of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution and the parallel TV documentary, and the proliferation of micro studies of the War of Independence and Civil War seems to bear out the adage that, like politics, all history is local. But is it? Do we risk losing sight of the bigger picture of a world torn apart by war, revolution and state formation? What, for example, can either approach tell us about the particular abuse and violence directed at women hitherto ignored in Ireland? So to discuss these and related matters, we have on the far left, John Borgonovo. John, of course, is one of the contributors to the Atlas of the Irish Revolution. And beside me here, Linda Connolly. And to my right, Dara Gannon and Fergal McGarry. And of course, Fergal and Dara were very much involved in the latest History Ireland production. This is the third of our decade of centenary-related supplements. Now, when people ask me, like, what is the ambition of History Ireland, I always replied, world domination. And the Irish Revolution, 1919 to 21, a global history. We're well on the way. Now, just to get us started, John, I think it just so happens that earlier this year, David Fitzpatrick, Trinity College, passed away. And of course, his first major work was way back in 1977. I've forgotten the title of it now, but the
Politics and
Politics and Society, 1913 to 1921, which is a local study of the revolutionary period in County Clare. So maybe just if you just talk to us a little bit about how scholarship developed since that time.
Yeah, so I mean Fitzpatrick's article was his book was a landmark. It was kind of the first Irish kind of, even though he wasn't Irish, it was kind of Ireland as a study, looking at it from kind of from the ground up, looking at the revolutionary period. And he brought in, kind of class, he brought in land, he brought in different aspects of the revolutionary period from that kind of micro level up, from the local up. And that influenced a series of other kind of early landmark studies. Peter Hart's The IRA and Its Enemies, Joost Augustine's book on Mayo, and he kind of did a comparative stuff. And so a lot of that early scholarship used this local study model, which is a good way of getting your head around it. So one of the things about revolutionary Ireland, for people who've studied it, is that it was a decentralized revolution. So events, there wasn't one person driving the revolution. It wasn't a Dublin-focused or controlled result. It was all these little episodes in a small local environment, and so it's only by understanding that local that you get a national picture. It starts to emerge, and it's only been through a whole series of these local studies that we've started to see some of the differences, different manifestations, different focuses. You know, whether it's on, you know, there's more agrarianism in Connacht. There's labor agitation in places like Waterford. There's a lot more violent stuff down here in Munster. There's sectarian violence in Ulster. And it's all these kind of different revolutionary experiences that make up the whole.
Now, what sort of developments have there been in sources since Fitzpatrick's original book?
I mean, the massive releases, well, the British records have always been quite good. And, you know, they have also invested heavily in their national archives in Kew. In terms of the Irish sources, the big kind of breakthroughs have been the release of the Bureau of Military History, which was an oral history project, which took about 1,800 statements from IRA veterans. And that was been made digitized and searchable, which made it a lot easier to use. And then now more recently, we've had the Military Service Pension Collection, which are files relating to about 70 or 80,000 applicants for military pensions, coming among activists, IRA activists, Fianna Éireann activists, and a bunch of related material around those pension applications. And that's a trove of, and we're only starting to really tip into that right now.
Can you just explain that for any kind of non-academic people here? I mean, the military pension, basically, this was people applying for money from the government, right? So you had to outline in great detail, you know, who you shot at, from where, which house you stayed in. You know, so it's quite solid information, whereas the military bureau stuff are memoirs written 20 years later.
Well, they're interviews.
Right, right.
I mean, the bureau stuff is... some of it's ropey, but some of it's pretty diligent. You know, they were being interviewed by people. It was an oral history project, basically. The military service pension material, it's not just the individual applications. You have supporting letters. You have brigade activity reports. You have brigade organization reports. We have a membership list for everybody who's involved in the IRA, and for probably about 80% of members that come in them on, just... like that kind of information, which is extraordinary.
So it's pretty solid stuff.
It's solid stuff. Yeah. It was also produced in the early 1930s. So when this was still a relatively recent past.
Didn't David Fitzpatrick then also interview people? A lot of oral history in his book.
Yeah, he conducted some interviews as well. You know, those were 50 years after events. Okay. You know, people who do oral history I interviewed people. I don't know, Fergal, did you ever interview anybody who was... I interviewed probably five or six people who were involved in the IRA in the War of Independence.
But was that in the 90s. Was that a new approach at the time, though, John?
What's that?
That thing of doing oral history. Was that new at the time? The method, I mean.
I think it was at the cutting edge of kind of modern scholarship. I mean, I think with Fitzpatrick is really... he's a modern scholar in a lot of ways, which is why he had such a knock-on effect, not just in studies of revolutionary Ireland, but studies of immigration. He's really important in the Irish understanding of the First World War. And so all those kind of efforts, he really pushed out the boat. And he also produced a whole lot of really leading historians of modern Ireland as well.
Greg, I'll go to you. If you want to make... So John has... made the case for the local approach. So what about the... what's wrong with that?
Yeah. I know you like a fight, Tommy, but... I suppose what I would say is, if you want to analyse any problem or think about any historical event, different perspectives have different uses. So if you look at something up close, like the Irish Revolution, I think you can ask certain questions. So if you're looking at a particular, say... if you're looking at what happens in Cove in 1919, you can ask very specific questions like what kind of people joined the revolution, what kind of acts of violence occurred, what were the motivations for that. I think just as looking up close though gives you particular insights, looking at the bigger picture gives you different pictures. I mean, and normally looking at the Irish Revolution, we either do local studies, which, because they're so popularized by David Fitzpatrick, they became almost like a template. Probably it's the most popular means of studying the revolution. But the other very popular kind of framework that historians take for analyzing historical problems is the nation. You know, so almost automatically we'll write histories of the War of Independence in Ireland. Sometimes perhaps a wider nation, the UK. What I would say in terms of why there's a case for maybe stepping back even further and looking at the international or even the global perspective is the different perspective allows you to ask slightly different questions about different problems. So if we just take one, for example, maybe which I think is maybe a weakness of the local study, causation. What actually caused the Irish Revolution? Why did it happen the way it happened? Why did it end in the way that it did? Well, if you imagine sort of we're looking at the map of West Cork and we pull out and we're looking at the map of Ireland and actually we're looking at the map of Europe, what we can see is if you look at the pre-war map of Europe, the obvious kind of model of political rule is that you've got a small number of empires that rule vast territories which are multinational, multi-ethnic. If you fast forward to 1920, 22, you've got this patchwork of nation states. So you can see that the whole way in which politics is organized internationally has been transformed by the First World War. And I think looking at that then maybe gets you thinking about new questions about Ireland. Ireland seems to obviously fit into a kind of pattern which you see in Central and Eastern Europe, where empires have collapsed and new nation states have broken away. And then I think that leads to other questions such as, well, what were the similarities between what happened in Ireland and, say, what happened in Yugoslavia or Poland? More interestingly, what were the differences? Why were, for example, the scales of violence very different? So that's maybe one case for internationalizing the study of Ireland.
Well, can I just ask you, do you think that there was a tendency to see, up to recently, see Ireland as exceptional?
Yeah, I think if you're just looking at a local area or a national area, the tendency is that you will focus on what's happening in that area and miss the parallels. So, for example, I've just come back from Korea, where the Koreans are celebrating March 1st, which was the beginning of their independence movement, which occurred 100 years ago last month. And the Koreans were interested in looking at the parallels with the Easter Rising, because March 1st was a popular uprising begun by intellectuals.
Is it against the Japanese, by the way, just to clarify?
Yes, so Korean nationalists read out a proclamation and the protests began. And it's really the foundation of modern Korean nationalism. But what struck me looking at what Korean nationalists did in March 1st wasn't so much the parallels with Easter Rising, even though there were some, but actually the parallels with what happens in Ireland in 1919. So the Koreans, for example, they set up a provisional government, they pass a constitution, they appeal for international recognition at the Paris Conference. So there's this whole kind of model of revolutionary anti-imperialist activism that you find happening at the same time in different places. So I think, again, that's another example of where the global is very useful. The third case I'd make, really, for why the global or the international is important is if you look at the Republican strategy itself. So there's political mobilization at home. There's a military conflict. And then there's a kind of international propaganda. But each of those three strategies are actually international. So what did the Koreans and the Irish do at the beginning of the revolution? They found a parliament and read a declaration of independence. International propaganda was hugely important to Republicans. Mobilizing the diaspora was hugely important. So even if you're kind of interested in telling the more conventional story of the Irish War of Independence, that's actually a very international story.
Maybe if it went to you, Dara, just to give us a particular example of this. In January 1919, Dáil Éireann was established, which claimed to be the government of Ireland, right? And obviously, like any government, you have to have a foreign office. So, what was their approach to this aspect?
It's a really interesting point to bring up Dáil Éireann, because it's very often heralded in Irish history and Irish commemoration as the foundation stone, the kind of cornerstone or keystone of Irish political life and Irish constitutional democracy. But of course, it was also very much part, as Fergal has already alluded to, of this contemporary European, indeed worldwide, Wilsonian moment, so to speak. So when the members of the Dáil, 27 MPs, as they went into the round room of the Mansion House, TDs as they left, so to speak, on the 21st of January, when they gathered, they were essentially presenting their case to the world. And there are a number of manifestations of that. In the first instance, the proceedings of the first Dáil on the 21st of January were conducted almost entirely in Irish, notwithstanding translations of key documents into French and English. And this, of course, was the presentation of Irish nationalism as separate from British rule and indeed home rule versions of that previous to that. The documents that were issued, for example, by that body included a message to the free nations of the world in which they stressed the relevance of Ireland's claim to independence in the context of the post-war world, self-determination, freedom of small nations, and Wilsonianism writ large. And of course, the third strand of that particular day really was the delegation of members of the Dáil to the Paris Peace Conference at Versailles. At first, it was De Valera, Con Plunkett, and Arthur Griffith, who were delegated to attend the Versailles Conference, ostensibly to present to the world the de facto existence of an Irish Republic and Irish independence. But of course, there are two problems to that. First of all, De Valera and Griffith were both imprisoned from the German plot imprisonments of 1918. And secondly, when Seanty O'Kelly, who was delegated by the Dáil to attend Versailles to gain admission for the Republican movement, arrived on the 8th of February, he was prevented from entering Versailles. So what took place thereafter was a long
process. Can I ask
process.
You, when you said he was prevented from entering,
yes.
Does that mean he was physically manhandled? I'm just curious how that worked. Some guy said, sorry, you can't come in.
Yeah, so he went over ostensibly, actually, as a member of Dublin Corporation. And what happened was Dublin City Council essentially were going to offer the freedom of the city to President Woodrow Wilson, which was, you know, quite common across the United Kingdom at the time. But once he arrived in Paris, he presented himself in his true you know, political life as a member of Sinn Féin and Dáil Éireann, as Cian Chóir of Dáil Éireann, in fact. And on that basis, his credentials were not acknowledged in Paris. And he spent essentially then the next 3 to 4 months with George Gavin Duffy in Paris, trying to convince the 71 delegations of the claims of the Irish Republic.
Yeah, Fergal, yeah.
Well, I might add that experience is one that lots of different groups had. So the Korean representative had the exact same experience. The Japanese tried to stop him travelling. Eventually, one of them found a way.
The Japanese are on the Allied side. That's a problem.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so at places like Paris, you've got people like Ho Chi Minh, you know, representing Vietnamese nationalists, you've got the Irish, the Indians, the Egyptians. And so you can see these patterns develop. All these hopes were risen by the Wilsonian moment. And when America decided for pragmatic reasons that they would actually sort of, you know, keep much of the imperial sort of framework, you see then a shift from politics to violence. So you see that in Ireland, but you see that in places like India and Egypt. So if you look at the Sinn Féin general election manifesto in 1918, it's really interesting because they actually spell out quite coherently how they're going to achieve independence, and that's a kind of a political strategy. Give us a mandate for independence, we'll get a seat at Paris, we'll ask Wilson to recognise Ireland, and we'll take it from there. So it was quite clever because it was a way of sort of bypassing Westminster. And so the response to that failure is that you know, by mid-1919, violence has become much more part of the strategy than politics. But in retrospect, I think perhaps we can place too much emphasis on violence. And it's important to go back to looking at how Republicans at the time thought that they would best advance Republican interests.
You know, one thing I just say is Washington Street in Cork was named after George Washington in 1918 to an order to the Cork Corporation gave the freedom of the city to Woodrow Wilson to try to get him to visit Ireland. So it was part of this concerted, as Fergal says, part of this really concerted foreign recognition strategy that was essential. That was also part of the victory, and Sinn Féin's victory, was Sinn Féin was asking for a unified and a clear mandate from the Irish people for sovereign independence. That was part of its electoral pitch. And that was one reason. That's one reason why Labour didn't stand, because it was trying to get this very, very clear message for recognition, and there was an assumption that the Americans would support their claim.
Just before we go to Linda, yeah. I just want to go back to Darragh one point, right? Mm-hmm. Back to Sean T in Paris, because John Gibney has an article in the supplement with a very good title, "Dressed to Impress," right? Because you see pictures of Sean T O'Kelly and his wife. And they're dressed to the nines. I mean, presume these people are wining and dining, and you know they're costing a fortune. I mean, how did they actually finance this whole operation? I mean, they had this elaborate international operation all over the world. How did it work, like, from a practical point of view?
Well, that's actually one of the first complaints that Sean T. O'Kelly sends back to Dublin in his first letter. Is, you know, I'm not getting enough money financially from Dáil Éireann. I suppose the broader diplomatic corps are ostensibly supported by Michael Collins' internal loan, and then when De Valera especially goes to the United States in June of 1919. The equivalent of $65 million is actually raised in today's money in the United States, and £10 million in today's money at home, which are obviously astronomical amounts for a fledgling counterstate, which again was declared illegal in September 1919. But actually, it's an interesting question about the kind of the socialization. I mean, Annie Vivanti, who is the wife of John Charters, is one of the key makers of the Irish case in Paris, and is very seldom talked about in terms of, you know, she was a cosmopolitan poet, writer, and very much allowed people like Sean T. O'Kelly, George Gavin Duffy, to go from their kind of more traditional nationalist position into the more middle class society of Paris. And in fact, going back to Fergal's talking about, you know, why the global and so on, it actually foregrounds nationalist women much more than, let's say, the local case does. You know, people like Nancy Weiss Powell in Germany were very much at the forefront of propagating the Irish cause. So that's something we can really talk about going forward.
Linda, that keys up your intervention here. I mean, one of the things there has been maybe a bit of self-congratulation about is that the role of women is now being acknowledged in the revolutionary period. But there's one aspect of it you've been doing a bit of work on recently, just to fill us in on that.
Just before I say that, I think regardless of whether the revolution is local, global, national, I think it's also female, and that's very important to acknowledge. And also on Fitzpatrick. Fitzpatrick was very influenced, as he said himself, at his retirement event, which I spoke at last May, that he was very influenced by the methods of social science, in particular Arensberg and Kimball's anthropological study of County Clare in the 1930s. So I wouldn't use the word local. I would say there are different kinds of methods, some of them coming from different disciplines apart from history. And I think it's important not to fetishize the historical method, because there is an interdisciplinary approach as well. You might call it oral history. Well, you know, Arensberg and Kimball were gathering such data in the 1930s. So I think we should broaden out a little bit beyond that kind of narrow definition of what history is. It can be many things. I would say that because I'm a sociologist. So with a strong historical interest, obviously. So some of us work across those boundaries, whether it be local, national, or global. So there's a methods aspect, I think, here that's been missed as well. So I've been looking at different aspects of the revolution. I suppose just to put that in context, regardless of where we're talking about revolutions, they have a couple of things in common internationally, particularly where they lead to regime change. And that is that women are always to the forefront of revolutions, as you said, critical actors operating in highly sophisticated ways. But when the regime change happens, men tend to take the credit and the power. So the military archives are indeed very, very important, as you say, Tommy, because 100 years later we've suddenly realised, oh gosh, the women actually did have a very active role, a very critical role. John, you've written about the women in Cumann na mBan. Many others, many of my colleagues have started to look again, to look back at what we might call the agency, the active role of women in revolutionary activity. And that's been critical. Having said that, I think we shouldn't be uncritical about the archive. Some of them are limited. There is material redacted in some cases, or names redacted. And actually, that's the kind of material I've been attracted to, particularly around the deeper questions as we move through the decade of centenaries. And we talk about violence, and in particular what we call transgressive violence, which are very difficult issues to face up to, particularly as we come to the Civil War. I think it's very important that it's not just a male narrative, that it's not a story of brother against brother, because we are looking at, I suppose, not just the role of women in the revolution as active agents, but it's important we don't romanticise that and look at the impact of the violence and the revolution on women. So I've been looking at that recently, I suppose, across...
Lynn, if I just ask, just before you go on there, sorry to cut across you, but you're talking about redacted documents. Is this in the pensions files?
So what you might find, for instance, so when people gave their statements, as John said, there were two copies. So there was one given to the person who gave the statement, and they took that home for the Bureau. Yeah. And then there was another copy is what we read today. So I've come across, for instance, instances of haircutting, which was prevalent throughout this period for different reasons. I suppose it was a way of controlling women, sexual policing, warning.
Having their heads shaved. Now, these be, say, women who are accused of going out with British soldiers or whatever. Right?
All of that, informing, being too friendly with the enemy, or simply not falling into line. So there are instances, for instance, where clearly these kinds of events are described, but the names of the women are redacted, for instance.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is this redacted now or redacted sometime in the past?
Yes, if you look up the statements now, the names are redacted, for instance.
But, and of course,
in all the cases.
The minute you as a researcher see somebody redacted, you're saying, oh, this must be interesting stuff, you know?
Well, what you do then is you actually use the local Fergal. You go to someone you know in the area who's a historian and ask them, do you know about this event or this case and what actually happened? Because you're building up, I suppose, as John said, this larger picture as to whether or not these were isolated incidents that happened to a tiny number of women, or whether there was this kind of systematic use of a practice against women throughout this period. And I think we know at this stage.
And what is the picture that has emerged so far?
So I think what most historians who have begun to look at this only very recently, Marie Coleman and others, would suggest that in the case of what we might called coerced head shaving or hair cutting, I think that's a limited definition because often it involved pulling hair, it involved verbal abuse, physical violence. It's sort of a continuum of violence that goes with that. This occurred with regularity throughout the War of Independence in particular. So there's a lot of interest in these kinds of cases as they crop up in the archives, and it is very interesting. But it has to be put in the context, I suppose, of wider questions around violence. It isn't a, and again, to get to the comparative aspect of this, Virgil, it's most interesting that if you look at most civil wars, conflicts globally, forced haircutting, shaving, shearing, whatever you want to call it, different names, is a feature of pretty much every conflict. The Spanish Civil War, the Greek Civil War, we know after the Second World War, Second World War, you know, French women who were presumed to have slept with German soldiers. Duchenne has argued that some of these women were actually raped and they were punished for being complicit in their own rape. So I suppose this idea of Ireland being an exception when it comes to violence against women can be very much challenged when we look at these kinds of practices. So we're gathering the evidence. Where did it occur? Secondly, looking at why did it occur, and how it's gendered, and how gender, if you like, in all of these discussions adds a further dimension, you know, adds a different kind of understanding, which adds to our understanding of the revolution. So it's very interesting that what occurred in Ireland has also occurred in many other conflicts, but again, we can ask what was specific to Ireland around these kinds of practices and how they apply to women.
John, Linda mentioned your work on Coming to Man, so do you want to add anything else?
Yeah, I mean, I think the scholarship on Coming to Man's really developed a lot in the last few years. I mean, there was great work done by Margaret Ward, Louise Ryan as well, and then it kind of a lot of people didn't touch Coming to Man. You know, a lot of the local histories, for example, had nothing on Coming to Man, and you know, it was this. It was with Sinn Féin. I mean, the revolution, if you want, the revolutionary movement was basically Sinn Féin, the IRA, Coming to Man, and probably the ITGWU. You can make the union. You can make an argument for that as kind of its component organizations. And, you know, not that much. And so, you know, that should feature in all kind of local or regional studies. But it didn't always. I think now I think that's changed, but it's only changed really in the last few years. Yeah. I think Marie Coleman and myself were the only people who had chapters on Coming to Man in their local studies out of all those. As I said, that's changing, and which is great. And you know, and as you know, to Fergal's point too, I think all this stuff is we're still in the early stages of the scholarship, and we're learning a lot more really rapidly. There's a lot of good work, so all this work is really important. What Fergal and Dara are doing, and this idea of understanding the international component, which is again, as you said, it's highly. You were talking, Dara. I was about Nancy Wise Power. I wrote a thing on her. I wanted to map her for. We got to it too late for the Atlas because she has a crazy. Like she, I wrote a big old kind of 300 or 400 word thing on her in the Atlas because she's a PhD student at Bonn, studying Irish. She speaks really good German. She's from this revolutionary family. Her mom is a experienced suffragist and lady land leaguer. She publishes the Irish Bulletin in German weekly. She's dealing with German arms smugglers. She's dealing with spies. She's followed by the British Secret Service. I mean, she has this crazy experience. And again, it's like all that kind of, that. It's interconnections about all these global networks. And like the more we understand put it in those kind of context, the deeper our understanding will be.
Sorry, just before you come in, I just want to remind the audience that this is a school and you are expected to do a bit of work. So if you have any contribution to make or question to ask, we have a radio mic here and I'd ask you to use the mic. This has been all been recorded, by the way, so nothing libelous, please. Fergal, you wanted to come in.
I was just going to say, I think when we're thinking about gender, we also need to think about how the history of the War of Independence was written. I mean, women had a much more prominent role in certainly in the Easter Rising and in the War of Independence than the histories that were written in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s made clear. And I think one of the reasons for that is when 1913 to 23 is a revolutionary period. You know, not just in Ireland, things like the communist revolution and so on in the Soviet Union. So things seem a little bit more open and possible. But what we see in the 20s and 30s is a very conservative free state, you know, very nationalistic, very Catholic. And so the histories that are written in that period tend to marginalise women. So there's a problem with the history writing itself that we've been slow to address. And the other problem, I think, is also one of sources. You know, because people aren't writing, women aren't writing memoirs, and women, you're getting accounts about women, for example, in the county histories, which are called things like "How do women helped?" You know, marginalised roles. There's a problem there. There's also a problem in the sources. So if you look at the military service pensions collection, which is probably the best new source we have in the revolution, it's very geared towards men because it was there was a kind of a gendered notion of what military service was. So if women were doing revolutionary things, political things, propaganda things, that tended not to be rewarded and it tended not to be recorded in the same way. So if you look at the files for women like Helena Maloney, sort of feminists who were kind of on the losing side in the 1930s, they're really sort of saying very explicitly that this whole thing is geared against women. It's geared against recognizing women's contribution. So I guess it's taken us a long time, both in terms of history writing and in terms of thinking about the sources, to deal with the very gendered nature of the society, which retrospectively recorded women's contribution and retrospectively kind of marginalized women's contribution.
Has been this project of what was called recovery work in relation to women's history, but a lot of it focused on social history, and it's only really with these new sources that the political history or the revolutionary history, if you like, that lens has also shifted onto that level as well.
Darren, I want to just bring you in here, just to go back to the global aspect. Obviously, there's a huge Irish diaspora all over the world. Like, so what was their role in the revolutionary period?
Well, I think that actually builds on the previous comments that Fergal and Linda made in terms of marginalisation and historiography. There is that sense within Irish historical writing that, you know, if one left the country, that one left one historiography and entered into another. And so therefore, you know, those who left Ireland, even in the revolutionary period, you know, were kind of fell between two historiographical strands, the Irish Revolution and then the diasporic strand. And therefore, you know, what a global history of the Irish Revolution can do is integrate the Irish in America and Australia, but also individual narratives of migration and displacement, which may not always have been positive and so on. And the most famous or infamous example, of course, of the kind of the diaspora story during this period is De Valera's tour of the United States between June 1919 and December 1920. And I think his period, which has of course been very well documented, really speaks to this idea of long-distance nationalism, which can actually transform our understanding of the Irish Revolution, because De Valera was not only touring, you know, American cities, he was also writing back to his colleagues in Dáil Éireann about that experience. That tour was being documented in Irish newspapers and so on. So we do have kind of a transatlantic, if not global, reading of the Irish Revolution contemporarily and understood contemporarily as that global experience.
So, and Fergal, I was going to bring you in. Like, how did events around impact then on the Irish abroad and in the British Empire in particular?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. Sometimes we have a tendency when we're looking at the revolution to think about it just in terms of what Republicans and revolutionaries are doing. But of course, there's a really interesting story to be told about imperialists, unionists, policemen. Like, for example, in the same way that sort of anti-treaty Republicans, kind of losers of the period, emigrate to America in large numbers, you see a lot of RIC men and black and tans moving on to Palestine and areas like that. This is the 100th anniversary today of the Amritsar massacre, and it's really interesting to think about that. That raises all sorts of interesting questions. So 400 people, at a minimum, probably much more, were killed by the British Army in the Punjab. And there's a very interesting kind of Irish dimension to that story. The general who gave the orders to open fire, Dyer, was actually educated very close to here in Middleton. The lieutenant governor, who was responsible for the very draconian kind of clampdown in the Punjab, Sir Michael Dwyer, he was an Irishman. So there's a story there about Irish. We can't just claim Irish revolutionism. We have to think of Irish imperialists. But also that incident, I think, raises really interesting questions about how the British Empire behaved in different ways in different parts of its empire. So when the Croke Park massacre happens, that's recorded in some newspapers as Ireland's Amritsar. But if you think about the difference in fatalities, it raises questions about, did the British feel, perhaps for reasons of race or reasons of distance, that they could kill much greater numbers of Indians than Irish, that they could repress them in a way? So it leads you back to comparative questions about why did revolutions work out in different ways, in different kind of contexts, and were there more restraints in some areas for probably a whole wide range of reasons than in other geographical areas of the empire?
No, I mean, one of the episodes of the Irish Revolution, of course, the Connacht Rangers mutiny in India, right? We did an article a few years ago in History Ireland, and some of the illustrations, little drawings they did, right? But it's very clear that the way they depicted, you know, the natives and the names they used was just straightforwardly racist, you know. So it's a complex picture, you know. On the one hand, they're engaging in anti-imperial activity, but it's totally disconnected to their immediate surroundings. It's all about what's happening back in Ireland, you know. I noticed, by the way, Dyer in his defence, or when he was, because it was an inquiry, and he said the only thing he regretted was he didn't have any automatic weapons at his disposal. I mean, they're all shot in an enclosed area, by the way. Just to,
I mean, there was a good article in Irish Times today. What I hadn't realized was Dwyer. So Dwyer, right?
Dwyer was the guy,
he's from the Golden Vale, and his family had been involved. They were involved in some aggro during the land war, where they had shots fired over his, warning shots fired over the farm, and that was attributed to his kind of fear of civil disorder. So I think one thing sometimes Irish historians don't speak to the international. So it's like a different conversations. So an Irish historian will go, oh yeah, like. It's not just he's Irish. He's from like a place that's a hotbed during the land war, and so you understand the implications of that. And that's what this kind of global idea is. I'll tell you another one about Cove. Cove's the center of this crazy episode with the Bishop of Melbourne, Mannix. And Mannix is a really big figure in Australian history. He champions and he's the front man for the anti-conscription campaign in Australia, where they reject conscription. And Mannix is coming over to Ireland. He's from Charleville, and he's intercepted off of Roach's Point on a liner by a Royal Navy destroyer, and he's landed in Penzance. And he was always nicknamed the Bishop of Penzance after that. And he was banned from, and they refused to let him speak in Liverpool or Manchester or Glasgow. That's a big episode in Australian history. And kind of this fear of contagion, fear of the Catholic Church. And it shows you actually a lot of the British attitudes. They had racial attitudes about the Irish. But they also had really profound anti-Catholicism, and so they were always convinced that the priests were behind all this, because obviously Irish Catholics, you know, only listen to their priests. But it's joining up those kind of dots, Mannix and how his role, and how the Irish in Australia, who are on both sides, and all this kind of interconnection, which is, I find, really fascinating.
I think one of the things our project is trying to explore is this idea of connections. I mean, so you look at that incident with Mannix, and it's happening because of the Terence McSweeney, and that in itself is a global story, probably up there at Bobby Sands. Mannix is being taken off the ship, leads to a big strike in New York, which brings together African-American activists and Irish. Going back to the Dwyer incident, I hadn't realized that Sir Michael Dwyer, when he was... He was assassinated in 1940 by an Indian nationalist who came to London. And to this day, the date of Dwyer's assassination is a national holiday in the Punjab. So
we got him 21 years later.
But these incredible connections between nations, between imperialisms, anti-imperialisms, and we can tie them up by looking at particular stories or moments, I think, and it opens up a whole set of new questions. And I think these connections were much more apparent to actors in 1919 than they will be to scholars who are just looking at what's happening in a particular area, because we all sort of tend to focus on a particular thing, and by focusing you sometimes miss some of the connections which are obvious to us when we open up a newspaper and we see things happening in different parts of the world at the same time.
McSweeney's brother was well known, or was a minor celebrity in Canada, because he refused induction in the Canadian Army in 1917 and was sentenced to death. And he wasn't executed, but he kind of, as an Irish nationalist, he refused induction. And so again, there are these knock-on, as you said, connections, not just between act. It's a really fascinating global moment. And the big thing is that it's the revolutions in travel and communications are what make all this possible. And so what the Irish are doing is they're transmitting to a global audience, and that's their, as you said, that's a core part of what they're trying to achieve.
Can I just answer, why do some events resonate more than others? Like, I think in particular of the death of Terence McSweeney. That seemed to be a huge worldwide event. Why is that, or why was that?
I suppose it's a particularly dramatic moment. There's a lot of parallels with Bobby Sands, I think. You've got this one man who is making a symbol of his defiance through his suffering and his bravery. It goes back to John's point, I think, too, about the media. The media is hugely important. I think this is only becoming possible in the 1910s in the way that it is... in the way that news can travel within hours, within a day. I mean, a particular kind of moment when this is obvious is the Easter Rising. I mean, the Easter Rising is front page news in the New York Times for about 2 weeks. So suddenly there's a kind of, the industry has made possible a kind of a global appetite for news. And I think McSweeney, a bit like Bobby Sands, a bit like Patrick Pearse, understood theatre, spectacle, myth, how to kind of construct a story that would grip public imagination.
And of course, it personifies the struggle as well.
Absolutely, yeah, weak against strong.
We also forget that Mary McSweeney is probably the best orator in the movement, full stop. Like, her and probably Father Flanagan are probably the best two public spokes. And so he also has a spokesperson who's outstanding. And so... you want to get in there?
I just wanted to shake it up a little bit, though, because I think it's really important. I read this review recently that Brian Handley wrote in 2016, and yes, we're talking about interconnections, and it's all very important, and it's all at the global level. But I think what Brian is saying very upfront is this is kind of post-revisionist agreement. And really, what we're talking about here is anti-imperialism on a global scale. And I see very little critique. I mean, I haven't read the article in the Irish Times today, but you look at the critique of imperialism. Now, I don't want to revisit the nationalist-revisionist debate, but in some ways I think we do, because there is this kind of consensual view, you know, of networks, of internationalism. And I would like to see, I suppose, McSweeney, I would say it was to do with the rupture in imperialism that was occurring in different parts of the world. So I would like to see that sort of more front and center in terms of that analysis.
Yeah, I always say, like, the British Empire is rotten. It's rotten to the core, and it really. I mean, it has parliamentary democracy, and that's great. But it was governing people against their will. Full stop.
I think also. Get
in quick.
Just quickly on McSweeney. It's kind of a reflection of society at the time, because at the same time, and you talk about the gender inequality and all that, Joe Murphy's death was as important as McSweeney's, and it was never mentioned. And it's only 99 years later.
Just move the mic away a small bit.
It's 99 years that Joe Murphy has been recognised. So society at that time saw McSweeney as the man in position, much the same as the British organized society, and Murphy was forgotten about.
You know? And Mick Fitzgerald, who was a union organizer and was both an IRA activist and a labor activist, and that's because it's a media moment as much as a political thing. Yeah, don't you think?
I was going to say as well, I think, yeah. Sean, you've mentioned this previously, as Lord Mayor, that's a title which has a global resonance, which translates to various political cultures, and obviously has respectability. I think, Linda, you mentioned class as well.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, you know, that literally will make, you know, Lord Mayor's death by hunger strike will make headlines in the American press, the Australian press, and so on.
It's also about novelty. I mean, it's the same applies to those who followed Bobby Sands or those who followed Kevin Barry. You know, we can't remember everyone. We remember someone as a symbol of a wider sort of phenomenon.
But, you know, he wasn't the first one to die, though. Yeah. Fitzgerald died before he did.
No, but I think there's a selectiveness around who is remembered, and that crowds out, you know, other experiences.
And he's also, you know, there's a couple of things going on, too. You forget that the McCurtain assassination was a global news story. So he was so part of the drama was, I tell you what's the thing with Sands is there was a question over whether they'd let him die when he was elected to Parliament, right? That was part of the Bobby Sands thing. With McSweeney, there was a question whether the British would take the hit of allowing a second Cork Lord Mayor to die. And so that added to the drama. And as you said, Dara, the title, you know, the title's symbolic, but, you know, in certain European cultures, it's not. It's a real administrative thing. And so if you think about McSweeney, he's the best front man the Republicans could have picked. Like, he's the full, you know, he's a poet, he's a playwright, he's a teacher, he's got a young family, he's a soldier, he's a statesman, he's all this kind of stuff. He's respectable. He's in terms of the class thing, he's also quite upwardly mobile. He's actually not, he's actually pretty working from pretty modest roots. His dad had abandoned the family and he went to the North Monastery, went to school at night, but he presents this image of the modern of what the Irish are striving for. And so, yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Sorry.
You want to get in there?
In a minute. Kieran.
Yeah.
Hi, Kieran. How are you?
I'm glad to see all that history has come out of UCC, because when I went to UCC, I would have liked to have studied history, and but I had to move to sociology as an independent test. I didn't make a very good sociologist, but I want to talk in general what Dr. McGarry was talking about there earlier, and a general thing about what the results of this whole so-called revolution is, because on the interesting aspect about McSweeney's hunger strike, you know, his wife went to Brixton Prison and appealed to him to knock it in the head. She said, "This is no revolution." Okay. Also, another interesting, maybe perhaps aspect is Ho Chi Minh, who was on the run from the French authorities in Britain at the time, followed McSweeney's hearse down to the port at down in London. Now, he didn't travel over it, but he wrote about that afterwards in his biography, about, you know, this whole thing that you may, you know, the whole thing that it's not those who inflict the most, you know. McSweeney's perhaps his most important contribution was his Principles of Freedom, which is very simply written, but it is an anti-imperialist tract. But Muriel McSweeney had it captured. You know what happened to Muriel McSweeney afterwards. She, you know, she wants her daughter educated in abroad. She lived in Paris and Berlin, and her child was snatched on behalf of the De Valera government, on behalf of Mary McSweeney and the family, who didn't want a child to be brought up in an atheistic educational system, whatever. That lady went afterwards to marry Rory Brewer, wasn't it? I think.
Actually, if you talk to her, that wouldn't be her interpretation of it.
The daughter. Well, they never spoke again.
Yeah.
There was no.
Yeah.
But and Muriel McSweeney never came back to live here again. But I digress in there. But I'd want to go on to the general thing. But when I did history in UCC, I just did it for a first year and then went on to do mostly sociology. I tried to, you know, it was a hotbed, it was well known, of revisionism, like John A. Murphy and Mr. Don and Dr. Don and what's his name, Keogh, and all these very, very sensible. And the agenda was so obvious that in the 1970s, 80s, they didn't want to make any contribution to the insurgency, any encouragement of the insurgency in the six counties, didn't want to do anything like that. So, and it is great to see that history, academics like yourselves are able to sort of break through that now. But that is in the context of that the crisis for the native bourgeoisie, the political ruling class is, as they say, is over. It's over now, and you're out. But I would like to think, one thing I was looking through, I didn't read it in great depth, and it's a great book, the directory of the atlas, I should say, of the Troubles, 1916-23, is a great, very illustrative. But perhaps it neglects to point out that the so-called Troubles, and I don't like using the term, it's like as if we all had it was a great migraine headache, it's very important, the Troubles, I'm troubled, and that's very important, language is very important, and the British use it all the time, the Irish Troubles, the Irish were troubled, it was a mental condition, the Irish were troubled people, how does history explain that a 29-month-old, that's all it was, 29 months of this, what some people call the Tan War, the War of Independence, casualty rate around 2,000 people roughly. Now, I know every death is tragic, etc., but how does it explain British willingness to disengage so quickly from this country after such a small... Now, my own explanation is, this is a leading question I'm putting to you. And what, may I say, history overlooks was the whole notion that the British had from the time in South Africa when they implemented a plan of neo-colonialism.
Yeah.
My mother is here, and she remembers this town up to 1938. The British had controlled this town. She remembers the British Navy, British Army, and this was a huge naval garrison, as you know. But the contribution, in Cork and all that, the British were under pressure in six areas of the country: Cork, Tipperary, Clare, Limerick, Dublin City, and Dublin County. They were martial law areas. Otherwise, it was pretty much easy peasy. You agree?
Mm.
So, surely the British, I think you would say, the actual casualty rate through the book was about 200 or 300 men they lost. Now, much more policemen killed, double that, and volunteers, so many hundred. But the casualty rate does not add up to a whole hill of beans. Like you spoke about Korea. I'm sure the slaughter there against
50,000.
Yeah, you can imagine.
I want to just focus in on the point you just made there, right? So what you're saying is, why did the British disengage? Yeah. Given that this wasn't, it was a modest enough conflict. Because I wonder, if you don't mind, to bring Darry on this, right, to look at the treaty, right, because that's what you're talking about there. Because you see, you get this view, you see, when you talk about a global history of the Irish Revolution, from the Irish revolutionary point of view, it's all fine and dandy, it's all going great, like they're getting this worldwide, and then in the narrative then, it all goes terribly wrong with the treaty, and then you have the Civil War. And of course, all it just dissipates the whole thing, right? Now, that has been the narrative, especially on the Republican side, betrayal and so on. But, and this is a point that Brian Hanley makes, it's not in the supplements, in the next issue of History Ireland, right? It doesn't take into account the major setback this was for the British. Right? I mean, people criticise the treaty, obviously, Republicans in particular. But in that narrative, there isn't sufficient credit given to the fact that the British lost more territory than the Germans did after the First World War, if you look at it that way. So in that light then, how was the treaty seen globally then, right, by other revolutionary movements?
Well, it's interesting as to the question. Again, I think we have to understand both violence but also political negotiation in global terms. And one of the interesting vignettes you get from those kind of diaries and retrospective accounts about the treaty, the negotiations of the treaty, is that I think it's Lloyd George brings Collins to this map of the world and shows Collins where Ireland could be in this kind of great, in this kind of operatic fashion of where Ireland's place is in the world. But those were the ostensible facts. Of global politics and so on. In the just before the signing of the treaty, in fact, there was an Egyptian delegation who were based in London who travelled over to Dublin on the recommendation of Art O'Brien, who's the London envoy for the Dáil in London, and met with Eamon de Valera and co to counsel them on how to negotiate with the British, because between 1919 and December 1921, the British were negotiating with Egyptians in London about self-government and so on. So there is this comparative element, as Fergal's brought out, in terms of how far constitutional politics can go and how far negotiation can go. Post-treaty then, you see, for example, places like Australia, Canada, those kind of news connections, as John mentioned, really espousing the treaty as a victory for empire in the post-war settlement. But quite interestingly, and going back to the debates, Republicans or otherwise, both pro-treaty and treaty advocates in the treaty debates in December 21 and January 1922 used the empire to position their arguments. So, for example, Pat McCartan says, we can't sign the treaty because this will abandon our fellow anti-colonial strugglers rather, in India, Egypt, and so on, whereas Collins obviously uses the stepping stone paradigm. So both Irish Republicans for and against the treaty were very much aware of that global imperial context.
Mm. I'd
also just add, going back to the question, that the British were leaving anyway. Home rule was in the statute book. What it was a 10-year haggling over the terms. If the Republicans had been successful, they would have left a republic behind. If the British had been successful, we would have had to accept home rule. And what we get is a kind of a compromise, with a dominion status. And what the British and the anti-treatyites couldn't have predicted, as Dara alludes to, is how quickly the meaning of what it was to be a dominion would evolve. So I think the first document to talk about the British dominions instead of the British empires, the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And within 10 years, those dominions had effectively, gained a relative status of equality, and thus the path to complete freedom was viable. And a lot of countries in Africa, decolonizing powers in the 30s, 40s, and in Asia, looked to Ireland as a really successful example of how you could not just use violence 1919 to 21, but how subsequently you could sort of get free of the British Empire through a kind of political process.
Fergal, this brings another point, the giving of a dominion status to Ireland, right? The point is, dominions, that was the British definition of self-determination at that time. So in other words, they were trying to put forward, and all the dominions were represented separately, were they not, at the Paris peace talks?
I'm not sure about that.
That's the very point I'm making. Yeah. That they are trying to create this idea that the British Empire is now democratic,
right?
for the white bits of it,
right?
And they want to co-opt Ireland into this global vision. White dominions,
which Republicans also ask for.
I mean, it's amazing when you think about the treaty. Basically, the Civil War is fought over the abstract idea of being in the empire, being out of the empire, because it's this idea. That's how seriously people took it.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, it just occurred to me now, it puts the thing of the oath and the whole thing in a different perspective.
Yeah,
it's not just, because it's sometimes dismissed that it was just a formula of words, right,
But the oath was inserted, so they had to assert that they were a member of the empire.
Right.
And people were like, no, we'll fight another war over that. So, which is incredible when you think about it, but that's also the global moment.
Just use the mic there. Yeah.
Sorry. For the Civil War thing, it is very evident that the British were very partial to one side. I mean, as far as they were concerned, and that issue was completed at the Civil War in 11 months or something. Okay, the Republicans were hammered, and that was down to the British giving as much military and giving as much material support to the Collins faction, everything from the forecourts weaponry down to their boot laces. It was just and seconding officers and NCOs from their forces. So for the British, really, when you look at it, if I might say, I don't want to say, you don't look at it objectively, but from the neo-colonial position, the British went out of their way to make sure there was a certain native class would take over, i.e., now we look upon the difference between the De Valera and the Collins faction as being Ashford. It was very much almost a semantic issue, like, you know, mixture of words. But to the British, it was very important that there was less radical, let's say, if I can put it that way, those less radical and those who didn't have the support of the Roman Catholic Church, right, which came behind the Treatyites, that they would ultimately control. So we're talking again about the British were relying on a neo-colonial regime being established, which they had done previously in South Africa. Isn't that correct?
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So I would say that a big factor in all this is they're afraid of contagion. They're afraid of what's going on in Ireland is going to infect Egypt and India. That's what they're afraid of. And that's why they're like, well, you know what? We'll give dominion status is like negotiating with Michael Collins. And I mean, like, that's, you know, think about, you know, that's a big deal. That was a big political hit for them to take. And they were like, no, we got to nip this thing in the bud because it's like a poison in the empire. And that's what they did.
Yeah. And it's bound up also with socialism and the fear of the trade unions within Britain. Mm-hmm. So it's, I mean, if you look at British intelligence, it's all one big conspiracy. Yeah. It's all connected as a kind of a fall of the social order.
And the Soviet, like, we forget the Russian Civil War. I mean, the British were intervening. The British tried to intervene in Russia and control that. And basically, there was kind of mutinies in their troops and on the docks. They try to intervene in Turkey, and the dominions don't go along with it. And it's like the whole thing's, as he said, they're fearful of a big general strike, and they're just fearful the whole thing's going to go up in flames. And so just cut off Ireland or the South. Yeah.
Getting quick again.
Just a quick question, and I don't know if anyone can verify it. Speaking, you know, about the weapons that were supplied and the forecourts and everything, it's something that's been denied over the years, basically. But there is a book across here in the Cove Tourism called the A to Z of Cork, which gives different explanations of different things and different place names and everything. And there's an article in there about the weapons and the forecourts and what happened after the treaty. And it states that at the end of it all, the British sent a bill to the Free State for 435,000, so many, and down to pennies and pence for the weapons supplied. Now, is that fact? Did it happen, or
they gifted them some stuff, like the armored cars and stuff. There was actually a cost saving because they didn't have to ship stuff away. So I looked at the figures for, I think they gave them something like 70 armored cars and armored trucks. And they also, they gave them all these rifles and Lewis guns, and they were geared, but they charged them, they were charging them, and they were loaning the Free State the money to pay it, basically.
It's a little bit complicated because prior to the Civil War,
sounds like Sean Quinn.
Michael Collins is swapping the guns that are given to the pro-treaty forces with the anti-treaty Republicans so that they can go up north to be potentially used against the six-county administration. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a tangled tale.
Just one thing also on the British imperial response in the 1920s, which is also that the Treasury were really tightening the purse strings in terms of what the Foreign Office can do. This is why, for example, in Iraq, which was originally supposed to be essentially a colony, they end up compromising and making it into something much, much looser. But I do have one question actually for Linda, which is, you were mentioning the gendered aspect of things like head shearings. I was wondering if you could expand on, in terms of terror and repression, the extent to which that was gendered, and because I know that's what your research, you've been researching into that, if you could just speak a little bit more to that, actually.
Okay, no problem. Sorry to change the subject. Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, I think we're at a very early stage still in terms of the recovery work that's required to look at this. I mean, with all aspects of violence against women, it's first of all very taboo to discuss it, particularly with something as sacred as the revolution. So I suppose in part there's first of all almost a kind of an inbuilt resistance to actually even speaking about these topics. But I suppose that's now beginning to change. And I suppose I have a very simple message in all of this work that I think it's very important to look at, in particular, transgressive violence against women, because if we can't look at these issues at a moment of commemoration, how can we address them in the present? And we know these are key problems today. So the kinds of issues I suppose we're looking at, there's very limited evidence, really, of things like, for instance, the use of sexual violence, what we might call a weapon of war, which, again, there's a whole massive literature since the 1980s in particular, you know, when we saw the kind of systematic rape of women in Rwanda, in Bosnia, and these kinds of places. So even by 20th century standards and scholarship, this is very late analysis. We're talking the 1980s in terms of these very recent conflicts. So there was a very much established idea in Irish history that Ireland was exceptional when it came to particular forms of violence perpetrated against women in the revolution. And I very much challenged that. And I've challenged it by looking for sources that might tell us more about the kinds of atrocities that were committed about women, and or against women, I should say. And that ranges, as I said, the most common, I suppose, practice as a kind of disciplining of women was the forced haircutting I talked about earlier. But there's been a tendency to see that in isolation from other forms of violence, and also, in fact, to look at forced haircutting is not even really violence, that you're just getting your hair cut. But of course it is violence. It is violence. It's symbolic violence. It's about attacking a woman's sexuality, her virginal state. She's singled out, she's humiliated, and probably marked for life within not just the local aspect, but the communal aspect, which is very powerful in Irish culture. So you could look at communities, never mind localities. But the question then, what other kinds of things happened? So we know, for instance, that women were terrorized frequently through things like night raids. You know, again, you know, I've read lots around the Spanish Civil War, particularly mothers often at the forefront of the revolution, the ones in the domestic context, where they're literally defending, you know, they're the ones who were there. You know, men are hiding, whatever, but they're often at the forefront of the violence. And so what happened to women in domestic spaces, I think, is very particular to the Irish Revolution. When you look at post-Second World War II France, it was kind of very public haircuttings, humiliation of women, dragging them through the streets, calling them whores, always sexualized. A haircutting is the same. It's always sexual, you know, in its connotation. It's to humiliate the women and to sexualize them. But what happened to these women, particularly in the domestic context, is one way in which we can find clues and analysis. So we know the kind of terrorization, you know, the physical pulling of women. You've countless stories of women always in their nightdresses at night, being pulled out, being physically attacked. Some very violent scenes or violent stories of beatings, verbal abuse. So that's one aspect we know quite a lot about. We also know that women witnessed violence, and you talked about McSweeney, and again, the traumatic impact of women witnessing a close relative being shot or killed or whatever is also another aspect of trauma. So all of this trauma, if you like, we have stories of this, multiple stories of it, and I've looked at this in my research. We also have some evidence of sexual violence, and you know, as I said, I have a broad understanding of sexual violence. I think haircutting is part of a kind of, you know, an attempt to sexually humiliate women. Sometimes they are stripped naked, for instance. So it's about bodily, singling out women's bodies, I suppose, as sites of punishment. But when we talk about sexual violence, people often think you're just talking about rape. So were women raped in Ireland as part of the conflict that might have been different from what we might call peacetime rape? Because we know, you know, women don't just get raped in revolutions. And there are some instances and stories coming to bear. One of the ones I've looked at is the case of Margaret Doherty in Foxford, County Mayo, which was literally in the most recent tranche of pension applications last May, and Margaret's mother, Catherine, applied for a pension on her behalf. Margaret was gang raped by three members of the National Army. Again, very typically, just like I described it, dragged out of the house, stripped naked. Women were often blindfolded. There's another case in Castlecomer, two girls who, again, you know, they were dragged maybe a mile away and had their hair cut. That seems to be the extent of what happened. Often we don't know, there's ambiguities, it's not clear what happened. You know, so, but in some cases like Margaret's, it is very clear there was a court martial. So I could go on about that case. I'm kind of, you know, Margaret is, it's a very sad one. There are other ones, again, it occurs on all sides. And this is what I find fascinating as well about it, that you just can't say it was the British who were doing this or that it was the Republicans. This is, you know, there are cases in all of these. There again, a very well-known one in particular was the Eileen Biggs in County Tipperary is quite a well-known one. And I'm giving you the transgressive examples.
Alton Bay.
Absolutely. Eileen Biggs was again gang-raped by four members of the local IRA. One, the leader of whom is commemorated on two monuments in different parts of the country. So these kinds of very difficult questions. In both, the reason I would mention both Eileen and Margaret is, again, and I've seen huge evidence of this as well with a lot of the women, both of them suffered physically, horrendous physical injuries from what happened to them, obviously, but also psychologically. Eileen and her husband went to England. Both her husband, who was there at the time, they had nervous breakdowns and never recovered. Margaret ended up in Castlebar. And this is all documented in her file. It's really sad. You can look it up online, Margaret Doherty. And she died in 1928. She was the youngest of nine, the only daughter. It's a really particularly sad, I think, example of that kind of transgressive kind of violence. So what I would say to you is, it's difficult to quantify. I can't say there were 100 women attacked in this way. I can't say if there were 5,000. I just don't know, because the default reaction, it was silence, you know, was to really not speak about this. But we know, and I know from just a little bit of the follow-up work I've done, particularly around Margaret, that there is still collective memory in the community, in the family, but it's very taboo. And I suppose my next part of the research is to think, well, how do I take this forward now? There's also a lot of difficulty with the sources. I mentioned this to the guys earlier. The court martial report is being held back. There's a difficulty with perpetrators. Perpetrators are rarely named, and never mind prosecuted. So should we name the perpetrators? It's 100 years ago, I would say, yes, this is a very difficult part of our history. It's a very difficult part of the revolutionary history, but it's not one we can shy away from. So I think the scale, the exact scale 100 years later, given what you talked about, Fergal, that like conservative Catholic state that we inherited, that had just a totally ridiculous attitude to sexuality and abuse. The Carrigan Report of 1931 was shelved because it pointed out levels of incest in families, suggested things like the children were imagining the abuse, that the women, you know, would be bad for the men's careers if this came out. So we have 100 years to unpack there. And it's what I call the hard end of what we're talking about here. Yeah. It's not the high political history. It's not the sexy stuff. This is actually real-lived trauma, abuse. And I don't care if there was one case or a million. I think those stories, I think we owe it to those women in particular, that we write back into the narrative those perhaps more unsavoury and difficult questions about the revolution. Yeah.
Get in quick by
Niall.
not wishing to shy away from the violence either, but I have a question for Dara and or Fergal, but just alluding to Fergal, you mentioned there the later looking of colonial African and perhaps other countries to the example of what happened in Ireland. I just wondered, other than the military side of what happened in Ireland, to what extent, if any, was the operation of the counter-state in revolutionary Ireland and attempts to operate alternative government structure centrally or locally, to what extent, if any, have you examined, was that example used in other imperial colonies?
I think it was Peter Hart years ago who wrote that Irish Republicans had almost fashioned the revolutionary template for anti-imperialist struggle in 1919. He talked about provisional governments, guerrilla warfare, political mobilization, international propaganda, mobilizing the diaspora, and so on. But and I think there's something to that, that what happened in Ireland was very distinctive and all history is unique, and it was very, very successful, and there's lots of evidence that anti-imperialists throughout Asia and Africa and other places did look with great interest to Ireland. And going back to what the point that was made earlier, the outcome in 1921 impressed a lot of people outside Ireland more than it impressed anti-treaty Republicans as a kind of an achievement. But having said that, the thing that's really struck me, and this goes back to Linda's comment about thinking about how anti-imperialism was in some ways a bit airbrushed out of history, was that 1919 was an anti-imperialist year, and looking at what's happening in places like Egypt and India and so on, what's really, I think, apparent is how a lot of different nationalist groups were everywhere using the same kind of language, the same kind of rhetoric, the same kind of strategies, you know, albeit with differences. So that combination of kind of political mobilization, use of violence, international propaganda, and in particular the claim to sort of self-determination based upon, you know, the Wilsonian moment, that what I've been really struck by how actually maybe Ireland was considerably less distinctive. Its path was less special that we think when we look at what else is happening in other places in 1919. And we're learning more, I guess, about how people, whether it's De Valera in America, how actually these revolutionary movements rubbed up against each other all the time and shared kind of strategies. So I've been kind of more impressed than that by than the idea of Ireland as a kind of leading the way in the kind of anti-colonial, you know, struggle.
Speaking of David Fitzpatrick, like one thing he mentioned in his book on Harry Boland, he kind of mentioned it, kind of dismissed it in passing, that Harry Boland was talking about creating a global IRB, an anti-imperial global IRB. It's like, sign me up for that. Like, yeah. but I just thought that was fascinating. I don't know how developed it was, but have you guys seen much of that?
Not specifically the IRB, but I will just go back to that point briefly because I think it links to the 1916 Rising and the kind of the misapplied term Sinn Féin Rising. There is very much in what Fergal was saying, this kind of anti-imperial moment, an anti-imperial year as 1919. But Sinn Féin, the category, the brand Sinn Féin carried across languages. So for example, Burmese nationalists wrote to Arthur Brian in London saying, Burma has gone Sinn Féin. Indian nationalists were saying they were going to establish a congress along the Sinn Féin lines. And even in news reportage, which has been great for me, and as Fergal as well, I presume, like you're looking at foreign language newspapers. And so the Sinn Féin title actually carries. So Sinn Féin becomes not only a representation of kind of this advanced Irish nationalism, republicanism, physical force nationalism, but also a symbol or a totem for anti-colonial action of any kind in the post-war world, and is therefore treated as such by not only British intelligence, but by the British state at large.
I think also the other thing that happens in 1919 is it's the year in which nationalist struggle goes global. So I heard someone recently referring to De Valera sitting out the War of Independence in America. That couldn't be more wrong. America was just as much the front line as what was happening in Cork. And it's because, you know, you could leverage and you could use that kind of global audience to press. It goes back to the earlier question about why Britain conceded with relatively few fatalities, because they were getting absolutely monstered by the global press. And they just really couldn't construct an argument as to why in the age of self-determination they could continue to rule Ireland against its clearly expressed democratic will. So that's, for me, that's the revolutionary shift. It just becomes very difficult to make that argument.
Guys, I'm looking at the we've been beaten by the clock again. Does anybody want to come in briefly? If not, just to wrap up, Fergal, maybe just to wrap up, where's this all going? I know, apart from world domination, right? And by this publication, right? Where is this approach leading us? Like, what's next on the agenda?
Well, I mean, our project is doing lots of work in the global, but I don't want to claim we have some kind of ownership of it. There's actually lots of scholars who are doing different things. So what I would maybe say is we've reached a situation whereby there's maybe a greater awareness of how we can look at different scales. We can look at the local, the national, the international, the global, and particularly what looking at the global is doing, which lots and lots of scholars are doing anyway, is that it sort of opens up new perspectives and old questions, like really straightforward questions like why were Irish Republicans successfully, but also it opens up maybe new questions for us to think about. For example, something that's emerged a lot today that there isn't a lot written about, race. You know, yeah. How important is, I mean, Irish Republicans, as well as forming alliances with, say, Indian anti-imperialists, they also would speak to white audiences in America and say, why should we be the last white people left on free? So I think that the global maybe just gives us a set of new questions and a set of new perspectives on old questions.
Okay, I tell you, I'm going to wrap up there, right? I just said thank all our speakers, Fergal McGarry, Darragh Gannon, Linda Connolly, John Borgonovo, you, the audience, a small audience, but quality is what we look for here. And the point is, this is recorded, so it's irrelevant how many people are here. I have to say, very, very excellent questions from the floor. Now, the next History Ireland Head School will be in Dublin, in the Edmund Burke Theatre in Trinity. This is the commemoration that everyone's forgotten, you know. It's 850 years since Strongbow came here. That's the big one. So the title of the next one will be 850 years of oppression, ? From beg and bun to Brexit. And it looks like that's going to take another 850 years to resolve. So hope maybe to see some of you there. Thank you very much for coming.